All right, everyone, get ready for I think this is going to be a very long episode. I was going to split it up into three different episodes to represent the three stages of this analysis that I'm going to talk about. This is estates and property. And there are three main stages that we'll work through. We're going to work through the present interest, we're going to work through the future interest, and then conducting a rules against perpetuities analysis as well, also abbreviated as RAP. This is going to be pretty long. I may need to take a break. And if that's the case, I'll just pause this, go get a drink of water, come back and start recording again. So if that's the case, don't mind me or don't mind any noises that I might make. Ultimately, this is something that is going to be a lot of detail. It's going to feel a bit like a fire hose. Yeah, fire hose fountain going straight in to my mind that is nearly considered to be overwhelming. But I just want to give a good summary of everything. And I think doing it one episode is a better way of giving a whole analysis, because you need to work starting from present interest to RAP to get a good understanding of how the whole analysis works. And I think doing it large picture like this is a better way of doing it than just breaking it up, asking you to look for each individual parts in different episodes. So that's why I'm going to be doing this in a whole long episode. We have already started talking about the present interest in our previous property episode. We talked about fee simple absolute and life estate, so I won't go over the details of those again. But it's just good to give a good summary of what they are. A fee simple absolute is just where somebody absolutely owns the property. They have that possession for all of time. And a life estate is when a person owns property for their life. And we'll get into some of the future interests associated with this later. But let's go ahead and finish talking about the other modern freehold estates. And when I say modern freehold estates, that's just saying this is a present interest estate. So starting picking up there, we have feetel. And a feetel is no longer common. They originated in England, of course. I mean, all of this originated in England, but they eradicated in the UK in 1925. And in the United States, only four states currently recognize a feetel as valid. And that's going to be Delaware, Maine, Massachusetts, and Rhode Island. What a feetel is that the person who's conveying the land, they convey it to a person and their immediate descendant. So if A passes on estate to B, and the heirs of his or her body, then what's going to happen is once B dies, the estate is going to go to those descendants. But if that line of descendants end, then A is going to have a reversion. That's a future estate that we'll talk about, and will then at that point retain the estate in fee simple. Now, in the states that don't recognize a feetel, the language of transfer here, and that's going to be very specific, and the heirs of his or her body, that very specific language is going to be interpreted to be a fee simple, because remember, a fee simple is our default. If the language is ambiguous or if it is invalid, we're just going to default to a fee simple. So that is feetel, and now we're going to be getting into fee simple defeasible. These are still present interest. There's three categories of a fee simple defeasible. Let's just give an overview of what a fee simple defeasible is, and then we'll get into each of these categories. A fee simple defeasible is, well, it's a fee simple. And it's a fee simple that could continue for eternity, or it ends when a certain event that is outlined by the words of duration occurs. So really what is, it's, so to speak, it's kind of a conditional fee simple. It's, this will last forever unless this happens. Now the words here are very important because it's going to determine which type of fee simple defeasible it is. There are three kinds. There's a fee simple determinable, a fee simple subject to condition subsequent, or a fee simple subject to executory limitation. Now the words here are kind of confusing sometimes, but if you think about it and carefully, like, for example, fee simple subject to condition subsequent. If you think about this, it's saying, well, there's a fee simple, and that fee simple is subject to a condition not happening. So if that condition subsequent doesn't happen, well, then the person retains a fee simple. And same thing with an executory limitation, where it's like, okay, so if this executory here doesn't claim this property, well, then you get a fee simple. But let's go ahead and just talk about what each of these are, how each of these work. A fee simple determinable is when the event occurs, the fee simple is going to automatically revert back to the person who gave the fee simple determinable. So, for example, if A is going to convey to B, if A conveys to B and its heirs, so long as the land is used as a farm, that is an example. Those words of duration there say that if this is used as a farm, so long as this is used as a farm, B gets to keep this property. Otherwise, A is going to get the property back. So there are four words that we need to memorize. Yes, they are memorization because these are the words that you use in your actual language to write a fee simple determinable. So long as, while, until, and during. So A conveys to B and his heirs so long as the land is used as a farm. A conveys to B and his heirs while the land is used as a farm. Or A conveys to B and his heirs until the land is no longer used as a farm. A conveys to B and his heirs during the land's use as a farm, whatever it may be. Those words are going to be fee simple determinable. A fee simple subject to condition subsequent is a fee simple defeasible, except it does not automatically revert the estate back to the original owner. So instead, what happens here is that the original owner needs to take additional steps to reclaim ownership. So the words of duration for this are going to be provided that, but if, on condition that, just those three, provided that, but if, and on condition that. So for example, A conveys to B and his heirs, provided that the land is used as a farm. And if not, then A may re-enter and reclaim. So that last little bit there, and if not, then A may re-enter and reclaim. It's not necessary, but it's good practice to have those words on there, because then it just ensures that we know who has the future interest. And in this case, the future interest is a right of entry. I didn't mention the future interest for a fee simple determinable. That's just going to be a possibility of reverter. Finally, we have a fee simple subject to executory limitation. Key things to note about this is that you're really just looking to see who holds the future interest. And in this case, the person who holds that future interest is called the executor. And so what happens here is that any of the words previously used for fee simple determinable or subject to condition subsequent can be used here to determine as well. So you can have so long as, while, until, during, provided that, but if, on condition that. All those words will work for a fee simple subject to executory limitation, which is why you need to focus on who holds the future interest. That way you don't get confused with the other two possible fee simple defeasibles. The main difference between these then is going to be that once the event occurs, another party, a third party, has a future interest in the life estate. So for example, A conveys to B and his heirs as long as the land remains as a farm, but if not, then to C. And it's going to be those then to C that is our key words there, because that is a third party who has an executory interest, a future interest in this land that makes it a fee simple subject to executory limitation. We have two cases here to illustrate what happens when the language is unclear. We have Marinholtz v. County Board of School Trustees of Lawrence County. I won't go into the facts. I won't get into the details. I'm just going to give a quick takeaway because it's a pretty complex case, and I'll mess it up if I get into it. But what this our big takeaway here is that if the language is ambiguous, and you know it's going to be a fee simple defeasible, meaning it's not a regular fee simple and it's not a life estate and it's not a fee tell, so it's going to be a fee simple defeasible, you're going to want to err on the side of it being a fee simple subject to conditions subsequent. And the reason for this is just because marketability. It ensures that it just makes it easier to sell land after the condition has been broken if the person doesn't come back to reclaim the land. It just makes it easier. And then our second case was Metropolitan Park District versus Unknown Heirs of Rigney. And what happens here is a question of, can you claim this land by adverse possession after the condition has been broken? And if not, how can you still retain that land if it's been a really long time? So the takeaway is adverse possession starts at when the person who has a future interest is going to forfeit that interest. So if they have not forfeited that interest, then you can't claim adverse possession because the time won't start clocking because you don't have any adverse or hostile element to it. But if they do forfeit that, then the time starts clicking and you can claim adverse possession because at that point it would be in adverse or hostile and all the other elements would be met as well. But if they don't forfeit their interest, possession can still transfer if it's a reasonable time that has passed after the breach and they don't come back to reclaim it. So this is going to happen significantly when it's a fee simple subject to condition subsequent. If they don't come back because the person has to re-enter the land, so to speak, reclaim it. And if they don't do so within a reasonable time, well, then that possessory interest, that future interest, is going to be no longer considered, and it's going to go to the park. Okay, so that's our summary of modern freehold estates and how they all work. We've got six in all. The last three fall under the category of a fee simple defeasible. But just to list them all out, we have a fee simple. Rather, it's a fee simple absolute, but abbreviated fee simple. We have a life estate. We have a fee tell, and then our defeasible ones is a fee simple determinable, fee simple subject to condition subsequent, and fee simple subject to executory limitation. And we talked about what happens when you have some confusing language between the defeasible fee simples as well. So that is present possessory interest. Now let's go ahead and talk about the future interests associated with that. So if you think about someone who has an estate, you've got a person who is currently living there. That person has a present interest. But then you also have to think, sometimes people write in their wills that after this person dies, this person is going to get the estate. Well, that's a time in the future. That's a future interest. So future interests are present, and we need to determine who has future interests, where they come from, what they are, how they work. And that's what this section, this third of the section, the second part, is going to be focusing all about. So a future interest is simply a person's right to possess a fee simple at a future time. We've been talking about present interest and the future. We've been talking about present interest and the future interests that are associated with it, because a lot of the time there is a future interest associated with it. The vast majority of the time, there's a future interest. So the present interest, let's just work down the list and then state the future interest associated with it. A fee simple has no future interest, and that's because the person possesses the land for all time. So a fee simple, no future interest. A life estate can have a future interest of either a reversion or a remainder. A fee tell has the future interest of a reversion. A fee simple determinable has a possibility of reverter, that's different than a reversion. A fee simple subject to condition subsequent has a right of entry. And a fee simple subject to executory limitation has an executory interest. Okay, so let's break these future interests down into categories. Who do these future interests go to? Well, there's two categories. They can be retained by the transferor, or they can be created in the transferee. So the transferor is also known as a grantor. This is the person who first initially conveys the land. So when we have an example of A conveys to B, A, in that instance, is the grantor or the transferor. Those terms are used interchangeably. The future interest associated with this individual is a reversion, a possibility of reverter, and a right of entry. So notice two of those are associated only with fee simple to feasible terms. For example, the possibility of reverter comes only with the fee simple determinable, and the right of entry comes only with the fee simple subject to a condition subsequent. Now, the reversion can come in a couple of ways. It can come either in a life estate or a fee tell, but that's really where the reversion comes from. And we don't deal a ton with the transfers. Our main focus is going to be a lot on the transferee and the future interest created in them. Okay, so now this is where things are going to get a little tricky. We've got our two main categories, and I want you to picture this as if you are on your computer, you're scrolling, you see this list of things, and it has the little plus sign for you to expand a box, and then once you expand that box, you're going to click on another thing to expand more options underneath that. So it's categories within categories within categories. That's really what we're getting at. As far as what's created in a transferee, you can have either a remainder or an executory interest. Now let's talk about remainders. Remainders, there are two categories of remainders. You can have a vested remainder or a contingent remainder. And then as far as the vested remainders go, there are three sub-categories. This is going to be indefeasibly vested remainder, note the word vested in there, vested remainder subject to divestment, and vested remainder subject to open. Note the vested remainder subject to divestment. Divest just really means to take. As far as our executory interest goes, there are two little categories there, but they're not really substantive. Those are shifting and spring. We'll get into them, but they're not really that detailed. Okay, let's talk about each of these in depth. Let's start with the transferor. The interests that are given to the transferor are given by the transferor, and then let me restate this. Future interests retained by the transferor. What happens when a transferor gives property is that they're really just giving part of what they already have. So A is given a portion of what he has to B. A reversion is created when A conveys a life estate and then does not create a fee simple in a third party. So once that life estate expires, it's going to come back to A. Now, a possibility of reverter occurs when you have a fee simple determinable. And so if there is a condition, there is a possibility that the condition could occur. And if that happens, then the possessory interest is going to revert back to the transferor. So there's a possibility of reverter because it could revert. Now, our right of entry is created when the transfer gives a fee simple subject to condition subsequent. Now, when the condition, this is when it does not automatically return. So the person has the right to go back into the property, but they actually have to take the extra steps to go back into that property. So they need to exercise the right of entry to retain possession after the condition has been met. Each of these future interests, a reversion, possibility of reverter, and right of entry, these are all alienable, divisible, and descendable. Okay, future interest created in a transferee. Once again, we have remainders. And how do we define, separate a remainder from an executory interest? A remainder has two elements. First element is that the interest needs to be capable of becoming possessory. So that means that this is, you could say it's sociable. It's always hanging around. It's going to be there with the life estate, but it's also waiting for the life estate to expire. And that's going to be the second element, where the current interest does not divest interest from a prior transferee. So it's not going to take it. It's going to be patient and it's going to wait. So that's a remainder. That's why it's going to come eventually, but you're not going to take it. So there are two main types of remainders. You have a vested remainder and you have a contingent remainder. And it's just easy to say if it's not a vested remainder, it's going to be contingent. To have a remainder be vested, there are again two elements. First, it needs to be an ascertained person. The remainder is given to an ascertained person. That's somebody who is alive when it's given and identifiable when it's given. So an example of someone who's not alive when it's given is an unborn child. And a person that is not identifiable at the time would be potential future heirs, because they would be alive if the person is still alive. Because heirs are not identifiable until the person has already died. So the second element is that it's not subject to any condition precedent. And that means that instead the condition needs to be subsequent, because if it's precedent, then it's going to be contingent. So if either of those elements are not met, we're going to have a contingent remainder. So there are three types of vested remainders. You have an indefeasibly vested remainder. And the definition of this is that the holder of this remainder is certain to acquire an estate in the future with no condition attached. An example of this is to A for life and then to B. B is going to hold, in this instance, an indefeasibly vested remainder in fee simple. And the reason why this works is because B is identifiable. He's ascertained, and there is no condition. B is going to get this no matter what, and yeah, so there's no condition. It's an indefeasibly vested remainder in fee simple. No, it's in fee simple because B has a fee simple absolute that he will be getting. The vested remainder subject to divestment is our second vested remainder. This is a remainder that is vested, but the right to possession could be cut short because of a condition subsequent. The keyword there is going to be subsequent, because if it's precedent, then it's going to make it contingent. So, for example, here is to A for life, then to B. But if B does not survive A, then it's going to go to C. B, in this instance, holds a vested remainder that is subject to divestment. Our third vested remainder is a vested remainder subject to open. And this is going to be a vested remainder that is held by one or more living members of a group or class, such as kids. A lot of vested remainder subject to open is, I give your children this land, and well, if that person's still alive and can have more children, well, then it's subject to expand. And so it's subject to open. An example of this is to A for life, then to B's children. I guess I did just say that. B's children, in this instance, has the vested remainder subject to open. Let's talk quickly about the difference between condition subsequent and condition precedent and the grammar behind it and how that works, because I think it's very important to understand. Otherwise, we'll get confused, because if it's condition precedent, then it's going to be a contingent remainder. But if it's a condition subsequent, well, then it's a vested remainder subject to divestment. And honestly, it's really a big difference between who gets it and when they get it and how they get it. And you can really only see it through grammar. A contingent remainder is going to be then to be if B. But a vested remainder subject to divestment is then to be, comma, but if B, dot, 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 comes before D, C, then D gets it, whatever it might be. You can see here there's a difference where it's saying then to be if B. B doesn't get anything until B does something. And in that case, it's a condition precedent. B has to do something to get it. But if it's a condition subsequent, you can see then to be, comma, but if B gets something, but then if B does something, then they lose it. And so that's the difference between a contingent remainder and a vested remainder subject to divestment. The vested just really means they're getting it. And a contingent says they could get it if this happens. So now we have an executory interest. This is going backwards into our expansion. And this is the exact opposite of remainder. So how is it the exact opposite? Well, the executor, the person who has the interest, must divest, meaning they need to take possession from either the estate or the interest. Sorry, the estate from the transfer or somebody else's future interest. And this is different because when you have a remainder, it's being given to you. But if you are an executor, you take it from somebody else. So when I say an executory interest is either springing or shifting, that I mentioned right at the very beginning of all this, is it's going to be springing if the executor takes it from the transferor, and it's going to be shifting if they take it from another transferee. So a good example from this is A conveys to B, A conveys to B until C comes home or whatever. C has an executory interest and they take the remainder away from B, and that's going to be a shifting executory interest. So C has a shifting executory interest there. I'm going to work through a couple of examples. These are examples given in our book and by our professor. I'm going to cite the book real quick. Our property book is called Property, A Contemporary Approach, 4th edition, by John G. Spinkling and Raymond R. Coletta. It's where all this information is really being derived from. And my professor has given us lots of practice problems for us to focus on. And I think it's just important for us to go over these practice problems just because you can see really how this works, who has a present interest and who has a future interest, and you can see why you start with the present and then recognize who has a future. I wrote some of these down. I didn't have these in class with me. I know a couple of them that I had written down are wrong. I'm going to do my best to go over them. I'll probably just go through five. maybe six, to get a good example of how this works. So here's our examples. O conveys to A for life and then to B. Well, O conveys to A, so A has the life estate because it's for life, and then to B. Well, B in this instance has an indefeasibly invested remainder. And that's because B will get it no matter what. He doesn't have to do anything for it. It's not condition precedent or condition subsequent, so it's an indefeasibly vested remainder. Two, O conveys to C for life and then to D and his heirs if D lives to the age of 30. So you can see here, C has a life estate, and then after that, it goes to D. And D, in this instance, has a contingent remainder that is a contingent on him living to the age of 30. Three, O conveys to E for life, then to F's children and their heirs. And then in this instance, we're assuming that F has never had children. So in this instance, E has a life estate. Simple. That's their present interest. And then F's children has an executory interest. Now, interesting thing here is that O also has a reversion. So the reason why F's children has an executory interest is because, assuming that F has never had children, after E dies, O, it's going to go back to O. And then if F's children come into existence, well, then they're going to take that reversion away from O, and so they have this executory interest. I believe that's right. Number four, O divides to G for life and then to H, comma, but if H does not survive G, then to I. Okay, so what's going on in here is that G has a life estate, and then H has a vested remainder subject to divestment because it's going to go to H unless if something happens. So somebody else could take it. And if that's the case, then it goes to I, so that means that I has an executory interest in G. Number five. O conveys to J for life, and then to K for life, and then to L's children, and assume that L is alive and has one child, M. Okay, so J has a life estate, and then K has a life estate, I believe, and then L's children, specifically M, because M's one child, has a vested remainder subject to open, and that's because M's future interest could expand to other future children. Okay, number six. This will be the last one I do. O conveys to A 15 years from now. So O, in this instance, has given it to A, but it's going to be taken in 15 years from now. So O still has it. But I believe what happens here is that O has a reversion. No. I don't know exactly what O has, but I do know that A has an executory interest because A is going to take it from O 15 years from now. So those are just a few examples of who has the present interest and who has the future interest. Okay, so that's two parts done. We're done with part one, focusing about the present interest, and part two, focusing about who has the future interest. It's been a lot. I know it's been a while. Let me just see the time. Yeah, we've been going for 35 minutes almost. So, we've got one final section of how this all works, and it's the rule against perpetuities. Rule against perpetuities, I'm going to do in two parts. I'm going to give an example of an overview of how it works here, and then in a different episode, I'm going to give a rule specifically for the rule of against perpetuities. So what is the rule against perpetuities? Well, we want to protect the marketability of estates. And so what it is, it's putting a limit on how long interest, a future interest, is allowed to be unascertainable. And that just means you can't just give it into people that are going to be, we don't know what's going to happen to the estate 50 years from now. And so we're putting a time limit on it. We're going to determine, hey, this is going to be last. It can be uncertain for your life plus 21 more years. So the way that this is going to work, I just pretty much say the rule, is when is that we need to ensure that the future interest will vest. So that means that the uncertainty is gone, no longer there, or forever fail. So that means it's either going to happen or it's not going to happen. And those two options need to be within 21 years of the death of the parties involved. Otherwise, the conveyance in here is void. And that certainty or lack of certainty needs to occur at that moment when the transaction is done. So an example of this, of one that doesn't work and an example that does work, is O conveys to B if somebody cures cancer. Well, B may or may not ever get that. It's uncertain when somebody is going to it's uncertain when somebody can cure cancer. It could happen in B's lifetime. It could happen long decades after B's lifetime. And as a result, it's uncertain whether or not B will ever get this property within this time period of his life plus 21 years. Now, a different way of approaching this then is A will give to B if B finds the cure to cancer. Well, we know now that this is certain. It's going to be certain when he dies. He will either, at the time of his death, have found a cure to cancer, or he will have not found a cure to cancer. So it will either vest or forever fail within that time frame. And we know when it will vest or when it will fail. And so that's really the rule against perpetuity and how it works. There's questions and analysis that we can do for it. First, we just determine which future in... Oh, sorry, I forgot one other thing about this. Only a future interests actually need to have a rule against perpetuity apply to it. This is going to be a contingent future interest. A contingent remainder, an executory limitation, or a vested remainder subject to open. And the reason for this is just because things could change. And so we need to make sure that we know when things are changing. That's the whole purpose against this, is to just make sure we know when things happen. So our analysis for this is that we need to first determine when future interests have been created by the conveyance. Second, we need to identify the conditions precedent to the vesting of the suspect future interest. So we need to ask, what has to happen before this future interest holder can actually take interest, possession of that property? Our third thing that we need to do at that point is to find a measuring life. So that means if in the instance of B's cancer, we're like, okay, B can die at this time. Will it have been certain at that moment when he dies? Another example of one that works is A conveys to B for life, and then to C's children when they reach the age of 20. Okay, so we're looking at our life holder here. It can either be B or C. And when B or C dies, say that B and C die a year from now. That means they have 21 years in order for it to vest. Imagine also that C at that point ends up having one child. Well, then will the child end up being 20 by the time the time meets? And the answer is yes, because at that point, C's child would be 21 years old. And so we would do a measurement there. And I guess I ended up getting into the fourth part there. So we get a measuring life, and that's going to be, okay, when does C die? And then four, we're going to ask, will we know with certainty within 21 years of the death of our measuring life if the future interest holder will or will not take possession? So that's just going to say, is the kid going to be 20 years old before the 21 years is up with certainty? So this is really just asking us to be very creative as we try and figure this all out. And to determine whether or not it meets this rules against perpetuities or this RAP analysis, this RAP analysis. Okay, that's our three sections, our present interest, our future interest, and then our RAP RAP analysis for our three potential future interests. Let's go ahead and just give one last step-by-step approach of how we figure out who has what, when they have it, etc. So the steps that we're going to take, first, we're going to determine who has the present interest and what that present, sorry, we're going to determine what the present interest is and who has it. Second, we're going to determine who has the future interest. Is it going to be the grantor? Is it going to be the transferee? And if it's the future interest, we're going to determine if it's a remainder or an executory interest. And then step four, if the future interest is a remainder, we're going to determine if it's a vested or contingent remainder. And if it is a vested remainder, we need to figure out whether it's an indefeasibly vested remainder, a vested remainder subject to divestment, or a vested remainder subject to open. That's our present and future analysis. And then step six is going to be, if that future interest is an executory interest, a contingent remainder, or a vested remainder subject to open, we're going to do a RAP analysis. And our RAP analysis is simply figuring out which future interests have been created, identify the conditions necessary for that future interest to be complete, look at the measuring life, kill them off, so to speak, and then ask, will we know with certainty within 21 years of their death, is that potential future interest holder going to take possession of that estate? And that is our analysis, three parts, 45 minutes worth. Have fun. It's been a good one. I appreciate you all. Thank you for your time. Bye. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Law Schoolers. Before I let you go, there are four things I want to say. The first thing is, if you enjoyed these episodes and if you enjoyed the website, I would invite you to go and join Law Schoolers Pro. And you can do that by going to lawschoolers.com/join. It's a way for you to support us, but there's also a lot of features there that I think you will enjoy. Second thing is that nearly all of our episodes are unedited. The only ones that aren't are pre-law materials, and the reason for that is so you can actually see the legal material in its raw form as I'm learning it as well. The third thing is that the information contained in these episodes are specifically only for educational purposes. They're not to be used as legal advice. And with that, the fourth thing is, if it is used as legal advice, we are not liable. That is, Law Schoolers is not liable for any legal outcomes. Thank you again for enjoying the show. Have a good one.